Bob Dylan is one of our most important musicians of the 20th and 21st centuries, but he's also Bob Dylan, which is to say, at the same time that he's a popular, an important musician, he's also a kind of cultural touchstone. And the idea of Dylan is almost as important as Dylan the artist.
Happy 80th birthday, Bob Dylan. It is May 24th, 2021, as we record this episode of Rock Conversations. Great to have you along. I'm Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, sometimes otherwise known as Rob Hahn. Good to have you joining us today. We have a very unique episode. Instead of focusing on just one interview, one conversation, we have three different interviews, including noted Dylan biographer Howard Soons. He'll join us in the middle section. We also have two college professors. That's right, we get a little professorial today. We will be joined by Richard F. Thomas, who is a professor of the classics. Ooh, the classics at Harvard. But he's anything but stuffy. Not only to incorporate Dylan into various classes, but he has a specific class devoted to Dylan. That's pretty cool. Our first interview will be with Gail Wald, whose voice you heard at the top of the episode. She is a professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and we will hear from her in just a moment. But I would be remiss if I did not share with you at least one Bob Dylan story. So it was the mid-80s, I think 84, maybe summer of 85, I can't remember exactly. And a number of us from Winona, Minnesota, where I grew up, drove to the Twin Cities, including my best friend Steve Tessman. And we were going to see Dylan and the Dead at the old Metrodome in downtown Minneapolis. And as a special benefit, not only were Dylan and the Dead performing together, but Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were backing up Bob Dylan. I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime event. And in fact, it was. It was an absolutely terrible concert from where we were sitting. Steve and I basically could only hear bass and drums for a large part of the Dead performance. They went on first. And Dylan wasn't much better. So we were a little disappointed, but, you know, so it goes when you're playing inside a dome. You never know how the sound is going to be. I talked to other people who saw the show, and they thought that same show, and they thought it was excellent. Well, nonetheless, we get outside afterwards, and we're killing some time before we have to meet up with the rest of the friends and head back south to Winona. And there was some guy who was talking quite loudly, trying to, shall we say, procure a certain substance for his drive to Brainerd, about an hour and a half away from the Twin Cities that night. I don't think that substance was legal at the time. And so we thought we'd play with him a little bit. And I said, okay, you know, what do you think? Have you been to Dylan shows before? Oh, yeah, this is one of the best. I said, really? It's one of the best? Come on. Oh, yeah. And then we got into the nitty-gritty. And I said, what's the best album? Blonde on Blonde, best album. So from that night on, whenever we mention Blonde on Blonde, it goes by just best album. Now, as you will hear, it is not necessarily my favorite. In my top five, no doubt, and still best album, but not necessarily my favorite, if that makes sense. All right, let's get to our rock conversation with Gail Wald. Tell me, it's nothing like starting with a real general question that's almost unfair to ask, but when you look at Bob Dylan, what's his impact on popular culture here in America?
That's a silly question it's a mean question to give me.
Absolutely.
you know, Bob Dylan is one of our most important musicians of the 20th and 21st centuries, but he's also Bob Dylan, which is to say, at the same time that he's a popular, an important musician, he's also a kind of cultural touchstone, and the idea of Dylan is almost as important as Dylan the artist. He, for various reasons, he's a figure that we continue to come back to argue about.
So let's not argue, but let's share thoughts if we could. Whenever I talk to Dylan fans, and I am one myself, I like to start with another unfair question, Do you have a favorite Dylan album? Is it possible to narrow it down to one?
Oh God, that's like not, that's really not fair.
Okay, I'll start then. I'll say that Blood on the Tracks is probably my favorite. And then I would, with the caveat that I really love Blonde on Blonde, Highway 61, and Oh Mercy.
Yeah, and see, that's not fair because you just named, you know, four or five.
I know, it's not fair at all. And, you know,
it so depends, like, what mood I'm in. At the beginning of the pandemic, I was enjoying listening to Infidels. I don't know why. It kind of came onto my playlist at some point, and I was listening to that when I was writing about Dylan's so-called gospel period or his Christian period. I was spending a lot of time listening to the three albums from the late 70s, early 80s that are associated with that period, and I was really enjoying them. So for me, it's like a question that really has to do with, like, what's your favorite at this minute, or what was your favorite last week?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So that's a cop out, but you know,
it's all right. It was an unfair question, like I said. So unfair questions deserve either unfair answers or cop outs. Take your pick. Let's go back to the impact on pop culture. What amazes me is how he's, maybe amazed is the wrong word, because that would almost suggest that I don't appreciate, you know, his talent, his impact. But it's fascinating to me how his music and his lyrics have really transcended different generations. I can look at my boys who are 20 somethings, and it took them a while, but I think they've begun to appreciate Bob Dylan. How do you explain that? Is it something that generations hand down to each other, or is there some other facet of it?
It's a great question. I do think that it's something that gets handed down. I'll answer that question maybe with a little anecdote, which is, I taught a class in the fall. This was online during the pandemic, at George Washington University, where I teach, a class to all first year students about the world of Bob Dylan. And it was titled The World of Bob Dylan because it wasn't just a deep dive into Dylan. It was using Dylan as a kind of prism through which to think about a lot of things in American history and American culture and American society, and to think about the people around who populate the Dylan story other than Dylan. So it was a broadly conceived course. And one of the things that, so I got to know these 20 students very well over the course of the semester. Some of them ended, so this is a way of answering your question. Some of them ended up taking the Dylan course because their parents were fans. There was that group of students. I would say it was a minority of students, but there was that group of students. There was a group of students who had, for whatever reason, discovered Dylan on their own. That was a smaller number of students. And then, to my great surprise, the majority of students who signed up for this class knew nothing about Dylan except that Bob Dylan was important. In other words, it wasn't that they had a lot of experience with the music or the biography. They just knew Dylan kind of the way that people know Shakespeare. It's important. I don't know anything about it. So I'm going to take a class with the words Bob Dylan in it so I find out what this is about. That was really fascinating to me, because that wasn't just about, like, kids who had heard, you know, their parents play the music, or kids who were interested in, like, neo-Americana folk and then were like, oh, I have to learn about Bob Dylan to really understand this music. So that said something to me about, like, the way that this is a figure in the air. That not many people occupy that space.
I'm curious to know, of those students who took the course, with the way they started the course, who do you think was most impacted by it? What group of those three?
I think the students who took the course because they had heard of Bob Dylan, who was supposed to be an important figure, came away appreciating not just Dylan as an innovator or as an important figure, but the tentacles kind of both reaching back and reaching forward and kind of horizontally, the ways that you could tell a lot of different stories about American popular music, American politics, American culture, using Bob Dylan, that he became an organizing principle for thinking about a lot of things. And so one of the things, and when I started teaching that class, being very worried that I was going to get a group of all students who were already Bob Dylan fans, maybe mostly young men, maybe mostly young white men, and that I would have to do work to get them to step away from us, a step away a little bit, to think about, you know, that the, and so it was interesting to have the opposite from what I expected, which is to say a class of mostly young women, including some women of color, you know, and who were not coming to the class with the baggage, if you can call it that, of knowing that Bob Dylan was great. You know, they had heard he was great, but they didn't know that. And so that made it much more interesting, because when they would say, oh, this is really interesting, or I really like this, that was very genuine. It didn't come from a predetermined sense of like, I have to like this. So I thought that was really fascinating. And those were the most moving encounters. I have to say, I did a lot of work in that class to think about, for example, women in Dylan's career. We spent a lot of time talking about Odetta. We read the wonderful biography by Dylan's first girlfriend, Susie Rodolo, who wrote a memoir of her time in Greenwich Village, but then beyond that. And the students were really interested in kind of thinking about a bohemian woman, and I think very taken with imagining, what if your first boyfriend in your whole life when you were 17 years old became this figure, and what would that do to your life? I mean, so I think there were all these ways in that included the musical catalog, but were not limited to it.
Okay, one more question. I think I'll leave it at that on the class. I don't want to belabor it, but did you get any student who said, listen to the music and thought, I don't get it. Why is this guy who can barely sing in some estimations so popular?
Yeah. Yeah. There was definitely that, but I think they, we did enough work on kind of, you know, talking about, right, one of the things that you have to teach when you're teaching students to think critically about popular music, you're also asking them to think about genre worlds, or to think about musical aesthetics. So to kind of teach them, you don't expect a punk musician to sing like Mariah Carey. They're very different aesthetics. And to kind of get them to kind of try to put aside taste, you can't argue with taste in a way. You like it or you don't like it. But to say liking it or not liking it, that's not the most interesting question. So in the end, I was happy that people weren't hung up on, I don't like it, I do like it. And then once you listen a lot, you're kind of like, oh, I kind of like this.
You ever think we're missing a voice like Dylan these days, or just that style of music where, you know, musicians kind of come to the, I don't want to say come to the rescue, but raise our awareness and pose things in a different form, not just a different format, but in a different perspective?
I mean, this is where I'm happy to be spending a lot of time working with 19 and 20 year olds. And I think I think we're living in a golden age of protest music, actually. Or I think we're living in another era. The Black Lives Matter movement has inspired so much musical exploration, response, leadership. I think you have to be a certain listener, maybe a young listener, to be in tune with the ways that musicians are seizing the moment and kind of teaching people and leading the way. And it's a certain kind of, you know, so I think from a certain perspective, we are in that moment. I'm actually really bullish on music and protest. I don't think it comes out sounding like it did necessarily in the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s. It's different.
Now our listeners can't see me laughing, but you can see me laughing. I'm laughing at myself because obviously I've kind of dated myself. And indicated that I may not be, shall we say, dialed in to a current style of music, and therefore sounded a little ignorant when I talked about missing, you know, the protest singers. I'm saying these dudes got to come out of retirement, you know, some of these 70 and 80s artists.
The person who I see in the contemporary moment being compared the most to a Dylan is actually Kendrick Lamar. who, interestingly, you know, Kendrick Lamar is the first hip hop musician to win the Pulitzer Prize for music a couple of years ago now, I think. And what's interesting about Kendrick Lamar is that he talks about himself sometimes not as a rapper or as an MC, but as a poet. And I think people appreciate the incredible complexity of his lyrics. And there is a way that thinking about Kendrick Lamar's approach to lyricism gets you a little bit close to Bob Dylan. I think putting those two artists together, I'm not the first one to kind of suggest that parallel. It's really an interesting parallel.
It's very interesting. Let's bring it back to, selfishly to each of us and our reflections on Dylan. Have you seen him in concert, and do you have a concert that stands out?
I have seen him in concert, and I don't have a concert. You know, it's because I'm too old. I don't have a concert that stands. I don't have, unlike some other musicians of my, I didn't see Dylan. I didn't get into Dylan until I was an adult. And okay. I think that's really different from being into Dylan when you were a teenager. So those magic concerts that, in my memory banks are not Dylan concerts. I did see him pretty recently, just before the pandemic. And
was he good?
I was really moved. But I know people, are kind of like, I can't figure out what song this is. I was really moved by the fact of him getting up there and having enough energy to be interested in his songs. You know, so I didn't approach going to, see Dylan, and maybe it was 2019, as like I needed to hear, I needed to kind of be, I needed to have an older moment matched. Especially as I get older, I'm really interested in, music critics as well as musicians who can stay interested in the work. And it kind of amazes me that here's an artist who, there's so much pressure on him to bring back songs from the back catalog that are the ones that people want to hear. And I respect that he kind of doesn't necessarily want to play to that pressure, but he still has to, and I'm interested in watching someone who's still trying to listen to their own music and find new ways around it. So I really like that about kind of the never ending Dylan concert and Dylan in the 21st century, that idea of how do you keep something relevant for yourself? And then the privilege of being an audience member and getting to watch someone who's doing that in front of you. Oh, boy, that's really interesting to me.
Yeah, you said it so well, because as I've shared with other people I've interviewed about Dylan for this podcast to celebrate his 80th or this episode of the podcast, I've reflected on both the good and bad. I've seen him about half dozen times and probably equally split. Some were really fascinating. I thought he was spot on. I could understand his lyrics. I knew most of the songs, even though they weren't necessarily all his popular ones. And then there were some where I would turn to whomever I was attending with and say, what's he saying? What's he singing? It was a little frustrating. But you're right, to be able to see him or to have seen him, a legend, obviously, is a great, I don't want to say an honor, but maybe it is. And secondly, to see him who can kind of go with the flow as he sees it. He doesn't have to play a greatest hits set every time he goes out on tour. Because I can't imagine, number one, having all those greatest hits to play, and number two, keeping them fresh.
Right, right. And I think, it's kind of a bargain, a pact between performer and audience, that if you're going to kind of be involved with an artist during a long career, as you yourself are changing in your lifetime, you have to be forgiving, right? People change. They're not, and so it's part, I feel like there's something very moving about the idea that, every time you see an artist you love, whether it's Dylan or someone else, you're a different person, they're a different person. And right. And in some ways the bad concerts are part of it, and kind of figuring out, which are forgivable, which you feel like are really not forgivable. And that's kind of the fun of, it's like having a relationship, you've got moments that work and moments that don't. But I think when you have a relationship to an artist who's continuing to put out art and they're living and you're living, it is a relationship.
Well, Gail Wald, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for spending time to chat on part of our celebration of Bob Dylan's 80th. And the celebration will continue beyond his 80th birthday as well. I appreciate it.
That's right. Thanks. It was great to talk to you.
I think it's fair to say that Howard Soons, a British writer, has penned one of the definitive biographies about Bob Dylan. And Howard was quite generous with his time, because on short notice, he agreed to an interview. And some of it didn't go too well from an audio or technical standpoint. You never know what the Wi-Fi is going to be. So I went back to him and I said, you know, could we re-record the second half of the interview, because what you said was so good, and the audio just wasn't quite good enough. And he said, sure. And then he got a little fussy. He was a little upset that I mentioned throughout the interview only his name and the name of the book, but not the name of the publisher. I think it's pretty safe to say today that if you have the author's name, or at least part of his or her name, and the subject of the book, and type that into a search engine, you're probably going to find the book in different places to buy it. I don't think you really need the publisher's name these days. Maybe years ago it helped. Not so much today. So I will tell you that the publisher of his book is Grove Press. You will have to wait a few minutes as we get into the interview to learn the actual name of the book. Ah, how's that, Howard? Let's get to our rock conversation with Howard Soons. Howard Soons joins us. He is the author of the ever-successful Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan, a book that was first published 20 years ago and has sold more than 200,000 copies. How in the heck did you try to encapsulate such a life that has traversed so many different paths, has impacted so many? Where does an author start?
Well, I started with my own real genuine enthusiasm for Bob Dylan's music, which I'd loved since I was a teenager. And it was a great privilege. It was one of the happiest projects of my life to be given this contract to spend 3 years traveling America, talking to people who knew Bob Dylan and putting his life into some kind of order. And I used to be a newspaper journalist. Unlike most of the Dylan authors, I'm a kind of proper background, you know, foot in the door news journalist. And so I'm not so interested in, you know, what the songs mean, man. I'm kind of interested in what Bob Dylan did on this day, and how do I prove it, and how do I unravel the mystery? What really happened about the motorcycle crash? You know, did he really do this? Did he really do that? And so I hope that Down the Highway kind of it cuts through a lot of the mythology and gives you his life, you know, as it really is. And he's nonetheless a fascinating character, and he comes through as a really interesting, charismatic, complicated man. But I've cut out lots of the mythology.
I'm a fan as well, so I'll kind of work from that perspective, and take a couple of my favorite periods and get your comments on them. I think, for obvious reasons, the great music, the Turning Electric, that 61, Highway 61 Revisited and Blonde on Blonde represented such a remarkable stage of his career, a great change. What in your research did you find unique about those two albums, that time period in his life that maybe hadn't been accurately reported previously?
Oh, yeah, hard to remember, to be frank. It's a long time ago since I studied that period of his life. And one of the things I did is I met all the musicians who worked on those albums. So I went to Nashville and I met all those guys, many of whom are now dead, who played on Blonde on Blonde. And of course, you know, they told great stories about Bob in the studio. And, you know, some of it's quite entertaining, and about how he would come in and he hadn't really finished writing the songs yet. And he kind of sat in the corner and wrote them on the back of a cigarette packet. And they didn't kind of know how long they were going to be. And there was lots of that sort of thing. So they found him to be a very unusual man to work with. It wasn't like working with Tammy Wynette or Merle Haggard, the sort of guys they usually work with. He was very different, bohemian, kind of inscrutable, unknowable, mysterious, intellectual, actually, of course, which is what he is. So, you know, he wasn't one of the guys, but nonetheless, they had a really great time with him.
You know, it's well documented that Bob Dylan is very private, doesn't open up to many people. I don't think he particularly likes when people want to write about him. Did you run into roadblocks when you were trying to contact people who had worked with him or who previously knew him or currently know him?
Well, this is a really great question and a very interesting and unexpected answer. I have written 10 books about all sorts of well-known people, and often you do get problems like that. That's quite common. And I've had very well-known people try to stop me writing books about them. Bob Dylan couldn't care less. He couldn't care less. He knew about it from day one. He let his children meet me. He let his girlfriends meet me, the guys in the band. You know, he wasn't involved. You got the sense he didn't really care, but he also wasn't, he didn't stop anyone talking to me. And often I go and find somebody who was a great friend of his years ago, and they say, what does Bob think about it? And I said, well, I've told him. I mean, and they said, well, perhaps I should ask him. And of course they would try to get a hold of him. Invariably they couldn't. They just didn't know how to anymore. And if they got a message through to him, the message sort of came back, it's up to you. It's up to you, man. Which is really kind of lovely, actually, for a writer, because it means that people do talk to you. Now, for instance, Paul McCartney, I read a book about Paul McCartney. I sat in a room with somebody, Paul McCartney, they rang Paul on the phone in front of me, and Paul said, don't talk to him.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I could have. Yeah, I wasn't happy.
I wouldn't blame. I don't blame you.
Bob was great. So, for instance, you know, imagine this. You know, I get invited to meet the children. Okay, I'm in the room with the children talking about Bob. Now, he must have known about that. They must have asked him, but he said yes, or he just couldn't care less.
Let's talk about the children, or one in particular, Jacob. Do you sense that, he's made a career, a very successful one, and rightly so, on his own. Was it a struggle, do you think, for Jacob to follow in his dad's footsteps, or did he use it to his advantage, or maybe a little of both?
Well, I think there's a lot of hype about Jacob Dylan, and frankly, he's not a big star now. He was a big star, you know, in the 1990s.
Yeah, had a good run. For sure.
He had one really big album, but I mean, I don't know what he's doing now. He made a pretty good fist of being a superstar's son, but I must say, I always think it's got to be a mistake to try to be a rock star if your dad is Bob Dylan. I mean, you know, how can you ever measure up to that? So I tend to think it's a mistake. I think he's a pretty good artist, but I can't look at him without thinking about his dad. And I'm sure that's true of most people.
I think you're correct. Yeah. We're talking with Howard Soons. He's the author of Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan. A new edition is out to coincide with Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, which we are celebrating. Dylan has influenced so many people, particularly other musicians. But in the course of your research and your interviews, did you get a feeling that from anyone or learn anything where certain musicians really influenced Bob Dylan? And maybe not going back to the, you know, Woody Guthrie days, but throughout his career, did he look to one or two artists and say, ooh, yeah, I kind of like that style, or maybe I can lift something, borrow something, as they say?
I went to interview one of the leading members of the Grateful Dead in San Francisco, and just to talk about Dylan playing with the band, and this kind of came up in conversation. We were sitting in a rehearsal hall, the Dead's rehearsal hall in San Francisco, just outside just north of the Bay Area. And he said, Bob actually wanted to join the band. And I said, really? I'd never heard that before. And he said, yeah, he actually asked to join the band. He had such a good time, even though it sounded terrible. And and he said, we had a vote on it. And one of the guys voted against it. And I believe it was Phil Lesh who voted against it. So don't know why he voted against it, but he just wasn't happy about it. And so it didn't happen. So astonishing thing, because of course, you know, can you imagine Bob Dylan joining the Grateful Dead? I mean, how would that work? You know, they become his backing band. But I think in his mind, he would somehow just be a member of the band. But I can't imagine it working.
And I can't imagine going back to Bob Dylan after he requested to join the band and saying, you know, Bob, we took a vote. We're sorry. We had one yeah. vote against you. That would have been a little tough.
I don't know how that conversation went. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah, it must have been a very awkward conversation.
Now, another collaboration he had, and you address it, I think, in the book. The book, by the way, is Howard Soons We're Talking To, Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan, and it's published by Grove Press. The Traveling Wilburys, on the outside, look great. Great names, great musicians, great music. And it worked. But apparently Bob Dylan did not enjoy his time with the Wilburys. Is that correct?
Well, my information from speaking to people who were intimately involved with him at the time was that he didn't enjoy it. And he refused to tour with them. He didn't do the third album. He didn't like the second album, which he made, I think, at the same time as Under the Red Sky, which was a very unhappy period for him. And he felt kind of put upon. I was told that he felt he had too much to do. You know, he had his own album, he had their album. George Harrison wanted to tour. He didn't want to tour because he had his own tour. And I don't think he really liked the music particularly. The music's very middle of the road, isn't it? It's not normal Bob Dylan music, I would say.
I would agree with you. It's rock pop. Isn't that fair to say, for the most part? You know, you have something like Tweeter and the Monkey Man or Dylan Shine, and that's not so much poppy. But beyond that, Handle Me With Care.
It sounds like a George Harrison album produced by Jeff Lynne, and that's not Bob Dylan, you know. It's a bit too smooth and melodic. It's not, you know, it hasn't got the kind of ragged, poetic, sort of bohemian freedom of a Bob Dylan album. Anyway, so I'm not sure he really liked it. And then, of course, I can't help but observe that when George Harrison died, and they had a huge memorial concert for him at the Royal Albert Hall in London, where every great star who'd ever worked with him turned up. Bob Dylan didn't turn up. And I find that rather surprising because they've been friends for years and years and years.
Do you think it had something to do with the relationship and the Wilburys? Did something deteriorate to the point where he just didn't want to be there?
I just don't know. I mean, I would just be guessing. I just don't know. It does seem a bit odd, though.
Dylan is from Minnesota originally, obvious to many, including those of us who live in Minnesota, like I do. And a lot of us feel that he's kind of got a love-hate relationship with the state, sometimes acknowledges it, sometimes doesn't. I think you portray a different view that Dylan has of the state of Minnesota, a much more positive one, I might suggest.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's his home. I mean, it's his home. He still owns a home there, a big property where he goes every year. His brother's there. They're close. His mum was there until she died and they were close. And, you know, I don't think he's anti-Minnesota. I think he writes about it very poetically in his wonderful book, Chronicles. He's a very polite, in some ways, a fairly typical Midwesterner in the best sense. You know, he's a polite, decent guy. And those are sort of Midwestern values, I think, rather than being a kind of pushy New Yorker. But of course, he had to leave to fulfill his destiny. He had to go to New York to be a star. You know, you have to go where the action is.
I was going to say there's some irony there as you describe him as a typical Midwesterner. We call it Minnesota nice. I call it Minnesota passive aggressive. But you're right. He spent a little time in Dickeytown, the neighborhood off the campus of the University of Minnesota, when I think he attended for about a semester. And then, ironically, he had to go to New York to become who he was or who he became.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that was his destiny. And, you know, he says somewhere, doesn't he, in Chronicles or somewhere, he says, you know, I came out of nowhere. I came out of the whiteness of the Midwest. And, you know, I had to go. I wasn't where I was supposed to be. I had to go to where I was supposed to be. So he has this sense of destiny. I think he talks about that in that Scorsese film. And I think that makes sense to me. But I think he goes back. He hasn't ignored them. You know, one of the best concerts I ever saw was Bob Dylan in Duluth and he seems so happy to be there.
And did the crowd reciprocate? Were they just as happy to see him?
Yeah. And he felt, you know, he told jokes. People say that he doesn't talk. He actually told jokes. He said, my girlfriend used to come from a house up there. I was born up there. And her name was Mimi because she was so conceited. And he laughed like he was like 10 years old.
But you're right that he rarely, at least the times I've seen him, he's uttered but a few words. I remember one concert at Alpine Valley outside Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was so bad, I couldn't understand what he was playing or singing. And at one point, he uttered like a thank you. And so I turned to my friends. I'm like, he talked. That was like the highlight of our show that night.
Yeah, people say that he doesn't talk, though, but actually he does. And I've often heard him talk in concert. The first time I ever saw him, many, many years ago in London, he was on stage. It was just after John Lennon was killed. And there was a big bang because something had hit his microphone. And he said, you can't hurt me. And then he bent down, he picked up, and what it was some fan had put a rose bud in a bit of silver foil, and they'd thrown it at him as a kind of gift to say how much they loved him. It had hit the mic, it had gone bang, made a bang noise. And, you know, he was talkative that night. You know, he can be quite talkative. He can tell jokes. I mean, literally, he will tell jokes if he's in the mood.
Well, speaking of Lennon's assassination, I think you observed or learned in your research that Dylan actually, I don't want to say became paranoid, but maybe extra cautious following John Lennon's death. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, the Tim Drummond, who was his bass player at the time, you know, who's a well-known guy, he's dead now. He told me that Bob, you know, bought him a bulletproof vest because he was kind of standing to his left and he kind of felt that's where the bullets would come from.
Oh boy.
But Tim said that he took it very seriously. And Tim, who knew a lot of, you know, people like that, he was very well connected. He said that all those big stars in the, you know, people like Jagger and Dylan, McCartney, they all felt, as I suppose would make sense, they all felt suddenly very vulnerable after Lennon was shot. Because, of course, A, he was their friend, and B, you know, you are vulnerable if you stand up on stage in front of, you know, 80,000 people and they haven't been particularly well searched on the way in, and there's bound to be a few nutters amongst them.
As we release this podcast episode, we're celebrating Bob's 80th birthday on May 24th, 2021. What do you think he's got left in the tank? What do you think he might want to do that he hasn't done or do again that he's already done?
Well, I think he really wants to get back on stage and tour because that's what he loves doing. Everyone who knows him well tells me that's what he wants to do. But, you know, he hasn't been on tour since 2019 due to the pandemic. That's his biggest break for a long time, for well over 30 years. And he's 80 years old. The last time I saw him, he didn't look too great. I don't know how many years he's got left. And I think that's the reality, really.
The book is Down the Highway, The Life of Bob Dylan. And it is published by Grove Press. The author, Howard Soons, has been our guest. It's been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It is probably fitting, as we've noted, that Bob Dylan has courses in college devoted to him. And so let's pick up on our academic approach to Bob Dylan today on Rock Conversations and feature our conversation with Harvard Classics Professor Richard F. Thomas. I want to take the title of your book, Why Dylan Matters, and put a slight twist on it for my first question. Why does Dylan matter?
Yeah, and he matters because he's Bob Dylan, not because of my own connection with him through what he's done with classical literature, keeping it alive and putting it into music and rock and roll. And so he matters for, in that way too, but he matters really because like many people, people like me have been following him for 50 years or more. And there's nobody really around like that, you know, his music of the 60s, 70s, you keep revisiting. I think partly his performance and the fact that he rearranges in performance and these bands that he's gone through and the most recent one he's had now for a number of years, that as a performer of music, rock music, whatever we call Bob Dylan, he's just without parallel across time. And so, you know, there's music that I have in my head from the 60s, pop music, folk music even, but that, you know, that's there somewhere, but I can't really revisit it in a living way in the same way that I that Dylan stays alive for me. So
outside of being a fan, you are also a professor of classics. So some might think this is kind of a strange route to take when you decided to write the book. What led you to write the book? And what was the reaction? I'm curious, number one, from your cohorts, your fellow colleagues, and what was the reaction from the general public, Dylan fans in particular?
Yeah, well, I've been a Dylan fan since my teenage years, so in the 1960s, that is, and really in the 90s, Dylan, particularly with the music that he was doing in 97, Time Out of Mind, 2001, Love and Theft, and so on, Modern Times, 2006, Tempest, 2012, and now Rough and Rowdy Ways in 2020. What he started doing, particularly with Lonesome Day Blues in 2001, is channeling, sampling, stealing actual classical texts, in that case, Virgil's Aeneid. I'm going to tame the proud. I'm going to war down the proud is the Virgil thing. So, you know, when he started doing that, I took a particular and slightly different notice of what he'd been doing. And, you know, I mean, everything classical at one point was popular. So you don't become a classic unless you were first popular. You know, a bunch of people listen to you. And if they keep on listening to you, you become something more than popular. You become popular across time, and that's sort of what classical is. So the ancient poets I work on were also rock stars in their own day. People would cheer when they came into the theater and so on. So I don't think there's that much difference, you know, that my ancient poets worked in different languages, in Greek and in Latin, but once you get access to them, or read them in translation, they're dealing with the same sorts of human issues that Bob Dylan's lyrics over time have dealt with. And they're dealing in terms of performance of that. You know, they perform it with music, which is one of the surest ways of keeping us in touch with our emotions, with the human issues that we think about. But when those thoughts are put into song and music, that's when something very powerful happens, and that matters. And so I'd say, yeah, that's sort of it.
So we're talking with Richard F. Thomas. He's a professor of the classics, of all things, at Harvard. Your book is Why Dylan Matters. In the couple minutes we have left, I'd like to just compare favorites with you, fan to fan, and get your opinion on the song from a lyric standpoint, how it might fit into what you teach. I've always been a huge fan of many of the songs, if not all of them, on Blood on the Tracks. Do you like the album, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was 24 when it came out. I was already a fan. I'd come to America with Blonde on Blonde and Songs of Leonard Cohen. Those were the two albums I brought with me. And yeah, when I first heard Blood on the Tracks, that, you know, that became my song generationally. I was 14 when I heard Sad Eyed Lady. So that didn't quite do the same. But when I heard Tangled Up in Blue, Shelter from the Storm, If You See Her, Say Hello, and those, all of those songs, another perfect album, that one. And it's been with me ever since. So, yeah, so that, likewise, I'm a certain, you know, I'm quite a bit older than you, but that from the moment I heard it, I was the right age to be hearing it in my early 20s. So it was sort of written for me, and you know, from where I was in life. But of course, even though, you know, one doesn't stay in that stage, the songs stay, and one's imagination of one's own experience, you know, which is what that song, what those the songs on that album catch are. It's why they endure. You know, I don't call it a divorce album, as some have, but you know, obviously, it's. Some of the songs are about relationship that's not working out and the memory of when it maybe did or how it stopped working out. That's that's pretty fundamental to all of us, right?
So, I think we can all identify at some point in our lives with it. What about an underrated album? Does one or two stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, Planet Waves, you know, which I heard, but then that soon got eclipsed once Blood on the Tracks was out. I'm not sure John Wesley Harding is underrated, but it certainly, in my mind, has always, come back as a pretty incredible song. You know, with musical history, what we, now can see and know that he was doing with the Bible, with Americana, and so on. And the recent albums, I don't know that they're underrated, but I like them from Time Out of Mind to Love and Theft, Modern Time. I like all of them. So if any of those are underrated, they shouldn't be, in my view. The 80s stuff, I think,
it's a little different, to say the least.
A little different, but I think Shot of Love is an album that is deserves to be up there. We could keep on going. We'd find reason to add all of the albums conversation. But
I don't know if it's underrated, but I would put, and I still call it recent, even though it's 30 plus years old, I think, if my math is right. Oh Mercy was one of my favorite Dylan songs from what I would consider, what the second half of his career. And it aligned with one of the best concerts I ever saw him perform. I've seen horrible shows and I've seen great shows. And on the Oh Mercy tour, he performed at the Erie Crown Theater in Chicago, and he was spot on that night. Do you have one show that sticks out before we wrap?
I'm not sure. I've been to fewer than many, but I tend not to. I don't single a single one out. I did like although I love Charlie Sexton and Larry Campbell. I also the recently late Denny Freeman. I loved the, which of course is the music on Modern Times, and why, a lot of those songs, Spirit on the Water, are pretty unusual, I think, musically. But I agree with Oh Mercy. I mean, Shooting Star, not the version on Oh Mercy, but in particular the unplugged version, I guess it is. Most of the Time, Ring Them Bells, those are fantastic songs. And Series of Dreams and Dignity, which didn't make it onto the album, and that part of the mystery of Dylan is why these songs that are outtakes,
We could all be so unfortunate to have outtakes that are that good, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
So, Richard F. Thomas, a professor of the classics at Harvard and author of Why Dylan Matters, available on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Great to talk, Rob. And happy birthday to Bob.
Absolutely.